Welcome to the next Oxford Institute for Energy Studies podcast. My name is James Henderson and I'm the director of the gas program at the Institute. I'm joined today by Howard Rogers, the chairman of the gas program and a senior research fellow at OIES. We're going to discuss his paper, The LNG Shipping Forecast, Costs Rebounding, Outlook Uncertain, that was published in February 2018. Howard, welcome. Nice to speak to you.
Thank you, Jim.
You say that the impetus for writing your paper was a perception that the convenient rules of thumb for LNG transport costs were becoming outdated. So before we get into the detail, can you just tell us what's changed and, you know, get into a bit more about why you wrote the paper?
Yeah, I mean, obviously LNG has been a huge focus of most kind of gas market watchers over the past few years, and a lot of excitement around the next wave of LNG supply projects. And of course, when people look at the relative merits of different LNG supply sources, the shipping cost assumption is a significant but usually not the biggest supply chain cost element. In recent years, shipping costs, charter costs have come down, and I just had a feeling that these possibly were kind of lower than a reasonable kind of equilibrium level going forward into the future. So that initially was the reason I looked into this in more detail.
So you mentioned the kind of recent movement in freight rates. I mean, they fell pretty dramatically. What were the specific reasons for that? How low did they go, and kind of what how big was the fall?
Well, the market tightened up as Asian demand rebounded in 2010, 2011. And of course, the Fukushima disaster in Japan caused a major disruption to LNG trade flow patterns and created a tight market both for LNG spot cargoes and the vessels themselves. As the market came off, we saw LNG freight rates fall from kind of 100,000 a day plus, which they had been in the past, down to around $25,000 a day during 2014, 2015 and 2016. They have, however, tightened dramatically over this last winter, which came as a surprise, really, because certainly in the IEA's WEO of last November, there was a sentiment that, you know, we would probably need more LNG carrier vessels in the early 2020s, but that things seemed reasonably balanced up until that point. I think this winter, a huge increase in China's LNG imports really added to the shipping mile requirement of LNG carriers, and so the market suddenly became tight, and we saw charter rates shoot up over the winter.
So presumably when rates were very low, people just stopped building ships, did they, or they were just losing money hand over fist?
People would stop building them on a kind of a speculative basis, on a purely kind of building vessels for the general charter market. But obviously, if you're a certain class of upstream LNG project investors, you tend to build ships to go with your projects. That's probably less so the case for projects such as the US LNG export projects, where the off-takers would be assumed to take care of their own shipping needs, whether that's through their own fleets or vessels on long-term charter, or accessing the shorter term charter market.
Okay, so I mean, just digging a bit into the detail, you built a reasonably complex model for calculating shipping costs. Can you just break down the main constituent parts for us?
Yeah, the first distinction to make is really what kind of vessel you're talking about, and there are two categories based on propulsion mechanism. There's the steam turbine vessel, which was universally popular really before the year 2000. And the beauty of that vessel is that it can use fuel oil or indeed LNG cargo boil-off to raise steam in boilers, to power steam turbines, to drive the ship forward. The disadvantage with that is that its efficiency was pretty low. And so since year 2000, it's really been superseded in terms of new builds by dual fuel diesel electric, which again can burn LNG boil off or fuel oil, but it has a much higher efficiency in terms of fuel to propulsion. And so really when people are building new vessels, they're not building steam turbine vessels anymore.
And so if that's a key element, what's the breakdown? I mean, when you created your model, what are the key inputs to your model, if you like?
Okay, so relating to the propulsion mechanisms then, the two key elements are the charter rate cost for the voyage and the fuel cost for the voyage. The charter rate cost for the voyages is the number of days at sea and the return leg times the prevailing charter rate that you're paying. The fuel cost varies between these two classes of vessels. To steam at 19 knots, a steam turbine vessel has to use its natural LNG boil off plus heavy fuel oil or other fuel in order to create enough propulsion energy to travel at that speed. The dual fuel diesel electric, however, can cruise at 19 knots using just natural LNG boil off. And so the quantity of fuel, whether it's LNG or heavy fuel oil or a mix of the two, is a key distinction between these two classes of vessels because of the efficiency of the propulsion mechanism, and that shows up directly in the transport costs for a particular voyage. Now, you know, you'd think, well, that's an open and shut case. The diesel fuel, dual fuel diesel electric is winning hands down. But of course, in a quasi-competitive charter market, all that means is that the DFDE vessel commands a higher charter rate. So there is some kind of market adjustment. Less clear middle of last year, but really the analysis for December shows that on a combined fully built up cost basis, there was little to choose between these two vessels because the charter rate compensated for the different fuel cost.
So there's not really an arbitrage between the two. I mean, how do the users make their decision? I mean, is it random what's available, or is there a positive choice being made?
Now, I think certainly reading and preparing to produce this insight paper, it seemed that if you had a vessel on, let's say, a year's charter, when you came off that charter, your preference was to move to a dual fuel diesel electric vessel.
Right. Okay. I mean, you mentioned earlier, and that's something I've always wondered about, the kind of the distances, and you mentioned the there and the back.
Yeah.
Charterers always have to pay for the return leg, is that right?
Yeah, they tend to. I mean, if they or another party can pick up another cargo on the ballast leg, then obviously that's an advantage. But it's unrealistic to assume that in every occasion. I mean, if you were going from the US to Shanghai via the Panama Canal, there are not many opportunities to do much on the way back, particularly as other suppliers that you might be able to access in the Asian arena probably have their own fleet of carriers, and so the opportunities is hard to come by, I think.
Okay. So you mentioned that the motivation was obviously there's been a lot of volatility in charter rates, and essentially we're trying to establish here what is a decent kind of long run assumption.
Yeah.
So where did you kind of get to in terms of relative to the history, what the long run?
Okay, so if we take kind of July of 2017, when rates were pretty low, as typifying people's kind of developed rules of thumb, then in terms of a shipping cost from the US Gulf Coast to Northwest Europe, let's say, we were looking at something like 50 cents an MMBTU. To go from US Gulf Coast to Shanghai, you were looking at maybe $1.10. If we kind of look forward into the future and say, well, if we're taking charter rates, sticking purely with the DFDE vessel, if we're taking charter rates, which sources indicate are the kind of closer to the long run cost requirement for building new vessels, then what we're looking at is from the US Gulf Coast to Northwest Europe, something more like $0.6 per MMBTU, maybe slightly higher. From US Gulf Coast to Shanghai, $1.50 per MMBTU. So some increase, particularly for the kind of US to Shanghai route, which I think will be increasingly important. So the difference there between last July is, you know, getting on for about 40 cents per MMBTU. So, you know, that's kind of not critical, but still an important kind of quantum to incorporate into your project economics or your kind of decisions to go for spot cargo placement.
And how much of the cost is to do with the route chosen? I mean, clearly it's the number of days, but I mean the like canal costs and things like that. Do they play an important part?
Yeah, canal costs are relatively modest, but the implication around Panama being potentially a bottleneck is potentially significant, because at the moment LNG ships only have whether it's the outgoing voyage or the ballast return, they only have one transit slot per day. That may well be increased to two. But if, as is quite possible, the number of US LNG cargoes trying to get to China exceeds that capacity through Panama, then the next best option is to go the other way via the Suez Canal. And I reckon in the future that adds a net 40 cents per MMBTU to the transport cost from the US Gulf Coast to Shanghai. So, you know, again, not critical, but, you know, that could have a bearing on the kind of future level of Asian LNG spot prices versus European hub prices if, at the margin, supply to China can't get through the Panama Canal from the US.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, just to come back to the market itself, you know, you've mentioned that rates rocketed towards the end of last year.
Yeah.
I mean, one, was that just a short-term phenomenon that's you know, was just a one-off market event? Because I think, you know, you talk in the paper about there being a relatively balanced market out to 2020. So, or is it a reflection of increased seasonal volatility in rates, or has there always been seasonal volatility in shipping rates?
I thought you were going to ask me that one, Jim. So I checked this morning and rates have actually started to subside. They're not down to last summer's levels yet, but they are kind of two-thirds the way down. So I think that this winter, characterized by the huge increase in Chinese LNG imports, you know, demonstrates that with that kind of surge in imports on different routes, then you are straining the capacity of the shipping market, and that immediately gets reflected in rates. As patterns readjust into the summer, we've seen those rates come down. So I think it will be seasonal. And of course, the key question is China going to repeat this next winter? Or, you know, will additional new LNG supply coming on ameliorate that somewhat going forward?
And I guess the other question is whether the volatility creates enough incentive for, you know, ship owners to construct new vessels to kind of potentially alleviate that the kind of supply demand crunches when they occur.
Yeah, I mean, I think with LNG vessels, there has been the kind of cyclical investment cycle that you've seen with upstream LNG projects, and of course, a lot of them are built as part of an integrated project, but allowed to play on the charter market, especially in the case, you know, until the liquefaction projects are completed. And then they're used for the original kind of integrated project modus operandi. I think the recent spike is an indication that the market is closer to balance generally all the year round than people had thought. And so you would expect that to accelerate interest in building new LNG vessels over and above those which had already been planned for new LNG projects going forward.
Yeah, I mean, does what's happened in the market and, you know, your analysis around costs suggest any shift in the model away from direct ownership by projects towards a more speculative spot market type arrangement, or do you think it's the similar type of balance now is going to be maintained?
Well, I think there's kind of a slightly deeper issue here about, you know, where are the new LNG upstream projects for the next LNG wave? Where are they going to be located, and what kind of project structure will they have? Because if a lot of the new ones are going to be US LNG export projects, where the off-takers seem to be increasingly, you know, the big upstream major oil and gas portfolio players, the question for them is, this is all well and good, but you can't expect new LNG carriers to just appear unless you either get them built directly yourselves or you cause them to be underwritten in some shape or form. So I think this, you know, what we've seen with charter rates this last winter has probably prompted some debate, certainly within that class of upstream LNG investor or off-taker in the case of the portfolio players.
And has it also prompted the debate, which we've discussed at the Institute before, about optimization of routes and you know, multiple use of transport or vessels, etc., etc., to kind of take into account the tightness of the market on various occasions, and obviously rising rates?
Yeah, well, I think that's kind of probably happening as more and more contracts become destination flexible. Clearly there is growing pressure for individual players to optimize their transportation, or, you know, you wouldn't get the same level of synergy as if the industry was kind of somehow behaving in a coordinated way. But I think through time we'll probably see more efficient utilization of vessels, but it can never be perfect, because things like weather-induced events will always upset, you know, carefully optimized plans. So there'll always be somewhat of a kind of last-minute response to demand volatility, as reflected in price volatility.
Yeah. You mentioned efficiency, actually, and one question that's just popped into my mind is, you know, are LNG ships per se becoming more efficient in their fuel use or the speeds they can travel at? I mean, obviously, there's the different classes of characters and carriers, and it sounds like the DFD is more efficient than steam turbine. Are there any other things worth noting in terms of kind of efficiency and improvements in the technology?
I think there are incremental improvements. I think the step from the steam turbine to the DFDE was a huge step. But, I mean, that was a fundamental one in terms of propulsion design. I think over the last few years, it's been an incremental improvement.
Right, okay. So just to kind of, as we sort of come to the end, in terms of conclusions, from what I think I'm hearing you saying, is a long-run marginal cost assumption for shipping from the US to Europe would be around 70 cents, 60
yeah, 70 60 cents. 70 cents in MMBTU.
And then for US LNG to Asia, around
150.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And so, and that would, so that would suggest that, you know, any short-term moves significantly below that can only be short-term.
Yeah, although the last dip lasted longer than people had expected, but I think ultimately, if you believe economics 101, you have to at some point get back to something like a long run marginal cost, and the figures that we've just discussed represent those.
Right, and so and the surge that we're going to see in LNG supply over the next couple of years, as the US, you know, projects and the Australian projects eventually reach peak, is that already captured in the shipping market? In i.e., ships have been built in anticipation. We shouldn't anticipate rates are rising dramatically as a result of that.
No, I think that the ships should be built in sync with that. The thing that would upset it, I think, would be unusual trade patterns emerging, but probably for fairly short transient periods.
Right. I mean, and one final question, just because it interests me particularly. We're obviously talking about ships that are travelling across, if I can call it, normal oceans.
Yeah.
We're not talking about Arctic.
No.
I mean, any sense of, you know, the kind of incremental costs of moving across waterways that are less than traditional?
No, my analysis didn't include specifically looking at icebreaker class. Although, you know, as we know, the plan there is to minimise the voyage length of the ice class and basically swap the cargo into another more conventional carrier through an entrepot depot such as Rotterdam.
Which raises the other question, which is, does transshipment add significantly to the transport costs, or is it sort of lost in the rounding, if you like?
It does. I think a kind of reasonable estimate of port costs is probably $0.2 an MMBTU.
Okay.
Very, very broadly.
Okay, fine. All right, Hag. Well, we've got to the end of our 20 minutes, so thank you very much indeed for your time. Very much enjoyed the conversation. And the paper, The LNG Shipping Forecasts, Cost Rebounding, Outlook Uncertain, can be found on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org, where you can also find all our podcasts in the multimedia folder and all the other papers and insights published by the Institute. I hope you've enjoyed listening to the podcast. Thank you and goodbye to everyone.